Justice Stacy is rejoining the courts. Is it Ms. McDevitt? Good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm Margaret McDevitt, and with co-counsel Rex Motes, we are representing the appellants in this case, and I would ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. You're not splitting your time with Mr. Motes?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. You may proceed.
Your Honor, the appellants are six homeowners who live either directly adjacent to or within 300 feet of the proposed site of a convenience storage facility that's involved in this case. The appellants are challenging the decisions of the Omaha Planning Board and the Omaha City Council to approve a special use permit that allowed construction of a convenience storage facility next to their homes and to amend the major commercial corridor to include the construction site, and that's also immediately adjacent to their homes. They're also challenging the issuance of the conditional use permit that would allow the industrial use of warehousing and distribution on that same site. The appellant's case involves their homes, usually the most significant financial asset that a person has, the place they've raised their children, and a location that they have chosen based on the qualities and characteristics of the neighborhood and reasonable expectations about what businesses might go up around their homes. Prior to the decisions of the Omaha Planning Board and the Omaha City Council, the appellants had assumed reasonably that although it was zoned community commercial, that neither convenience storage nor a warehousing and distribution site would be located directly adjacent to their homes.
What was the basis of that assumption?
That under, as community commercial, the characteristics of that kind of site allow certain businesses, such as a Quick Mart, a service station,
had this not been previously zoned by Elkhorn when it was an independent city?
Your Honor, I even believe with Elkhorn it was community.
And would that have allowed this very kind of space use that we're talking about today?
Your Honor, we don't think the record reflects that. That at the time that these folks, the six appellants, acquired their home, that they would have had a reasonable expectation that they could have a large storage facility located immediately adjacent to their home.
Counsel, at the city council proceeding, did the council mark exhibits and receive evidence? Were there sworn testimony at that city council hearing?
Your Honor, I don't believe that anyone was sworn at the city council. I believe, though, that there was documentary evidence offered to city council.
And they ruled upon it. So if we look at the record, there'll be exhibit numbers on the documents?
I don't believe that they were marked as exhibits. However, I'm not sure whether it's exhibit 4 or 3 with city council, that in that large exhibit, there are documentary exhibits that were offered by the appellants.
Okay, and that will be in the record somewhere. Somebody actually said, we're offering this, and somebody ruled on it from the city council.
Your Honor, in terms of the actual procedure of the city council, I don't think that they, as Your Honors or a judge would do, a county court, for example, that there was an exact admission process. However, in the record that was provided at the district court level, there were letters from individuals. There was proposed revisions to the project that the appellants offered at the city council level. So in terms of the procedures, it was not what one would expect a county court or a district court at that higher level of procedure.
I beg your pardon, and what did the district court do with the documentary record?
Your Honor, I think we can assume that the district court had that record.
And was that offered and received as a record such as it is at the lower level?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It was offered, co-counsel offered exhibits 1 through 5 at the district court level, and those records were admitted by the district judge.
Counsel, in the rezoning, did the city council act in a legislative or a quasi-judicial capacity?
Your Honor, appellant's position is that on the rezoning issue, that council was acting in a judicial fashion.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
Your Honor, no case authority. However, in terms of the Omaha Municipal Code and in terms of the record itself, that the special use permit and the zoning amendment were all considered at the same time. There's a reference in the record that it was considered as one case, that the same documents that were looked at, the same individuals, that it was a simultaneous proceeding, that there was no variation in how they considered the two issues.
Isn't the case law pretty uniform that zoning or rezoning is a legislative function, not a quasi-judicial function?
Your Honor agreed that there are a number of cases that say, in a slightly different context, that rezoning, zoning is a legislative function. However, in the cases, and I believe cited by the appellees in this case, that none of those cases involved a specific case as here, where there was both a special use permit and the zoning amendment considered at the same time. On the same record, Your Honor. And no discussion in those prior cases that I believe that Your Honor was referring to.
Putting aside the case law, isn't zoning a legislative function as opposed to a quasi-judicial function?
Your Honor, I don't think that appellants would disagree with that. However, procedurally, though, in terms of whether counsel was acting as in a quasi-judicial fashion, if counsel is following the same procedure, considering the same record, hearing the same individual, all simultaneously at the same time, that appellant's position is that they're acting in a quasi-judicial fashion.
In other words, you're essentially arguing that it's logically impossible for them to do both a legislative function and a quasi-judicial function at the same time, or the logic would be that the procedure that they used somehow, in a legal sense, converted a legislative activity into a quasi-judicial function? Is that the logic that you're proposing?
The analysis that we're proposing is that based on the Omaha Municipal Code and the way that it was implemented in this particular case, that it was a quasi-judicial function.
If we disagree, what does that do to the zoning issue?
Your Honor, in that case, then there would have been a different procedure that would have been followed.
Okay.
With respect to the special use permit and the conditional use permit, that the Omaha Municipal Code is absolutely crystal clear in terms of who can apply those kind of permits. And the Omaha Municipal Code says that it needs to be, the applicant is either the owner or an agent of the owner. In this case, the application, the only application that's in the record, was submitted by Mr. Lysy, one of the appellees in this case, and he designated the owner of the property as Ray Anderson. The record is clear that the actual owner of the property is Ray Anderson, Inc., a corporation. There's no evidence in the record, in any of the four or five exhibits, about the corporate status. It was not a deficiency that was recognized by either the planning board or by city council. There was no, I believe I'm out of time.
Yes, you are. Thank you very much. Mr. Thielen, good morning to you. Are you sharing your time?
Yes, I will. I'm only going to take 5 minutes out of the Applebee's 10 minutes. So again, I'm Alan Thielen with the Omaha City Attorney's Office. I represent the City of Omaha and the Omaha City Council and the Omaha Planning Board. Since I'm just taking 5 minutes, I just want to briefly make a few broad brush comments about the general merits of the case. It's been mentioned the developers in this case needed three different zoning approvals for their proposal: a conditional use permit, a special use permit, and a rezoning. And each of those is subject to slightly different rules and standards. An important starting point, of course, is the standards of review. For the conditional use permit and special use permit, those were quasi-judicial decisions, and they were properly appealed through an error proceeding by the plaintiffs here. The applicable standard of review for that type of case, error proceeding, is whether there was sufficient evidence on the record as a matter of law to support the decision. And this court on prior occasions has said that that is akin to the standard for surviving a motion for...
Counsel, are you stipulating then that the city council acted quasi-judicially on the special use permit?
Yes, we stipulate that the council acted in a quasi-judicial manner on the special use permit, and the Omaha Planning Board made the decision on the conditional use permit. They acted in a quasi-judicial manner. Yes. So with that standard of review, if there was enough evidence in favor of the developer to hold off a theoretical directed verdict motion against the developer, passed muster. That rezoning is a different animal. Rezoning is a legislative act. And this court has stated that a legislative act like a rezoning is presumed valid unless there's clear and satisfactory evidence to the contrary. This court has stated that in such a case, the plaintiff must show that the decision that the rezoning was unreasonable, discriminatory, or arbitrary, and had no relationship to the purposes of the rezoning. It suggests that both of those standards of review are very deferential to the lower tribunals here. We can set a little bar for the amount of evidence that's required on the record.
Do you agree as to the rezoning that an appeal from the city council to the district court is the appropriate vehicle for enforcing?
I do not. It's our belief that a rezoning is not challenged by an error proceeding the same way that an error proceeding is appropriate for a use permit. That's because it's a legislative act, and a legislative act can't be challenged by an error proceeding.
So it would take an equitable action for an injunction, wouldn't it?
That would be a possibility, or just some other collateral attack, yes. That's what would be required. There are several problems with the zoning in particular. In this case, the rezoning merely didn't change the base zoning of the property, the developer's property. What it did was it simply added an additional layer of regulation called an overlay district on top of that property. That was what's referred to as a major commercial corridor, or MCC overlay. That imposed, and our brief details this, but that imposed a lot of additional regulations on the property. Regulations requiring additional screening, landscaping, parking, access restrictions, building design, all of those things to benefit neighbors and the general public. So this rezoning, in fact, that was imposed on the developer's property was actually subjects that property to more intensive development rules. That rezoning helps the neighbors rather and does not hurt them. So that's why we argue that the plaintiffs here have no standing to complain about that rezoning. To have standing.
Counsel, I need to back up, and I apologize for interrupting you, but the other, your opposing counsel makes the proposal that because the special use permit and rezoning were considered on the same arguments at the city council hearing, therefore they acted quasi-judicially in both of them. With you stipulating to the special use permit, are you saying they acted separately then?
Yes, they had one hearing and got all the evidence in at that one hearing. Okay.
What evidence actually came in at that hearing? I mean, the record doesn't have any exhibit stickers. The opposition document was simply filed in, and no one was sworn as a witness. So what evidence did they actually receive?
All of the evidence, and let's start with the city council meeting. All of the evidence that was received by the city council, either prior to the public hearing or at the public hearing, is contained in Exhibit 4.
Was that offered at the city council hearing?
There was no formal offer. Many of these documents and items came in the mail or via email to the city council, to the city clerk, prior to the public hearing.
So weren't they simply filed in at the clerk's office?
They were filed, yes, and some of the documents were also presented in different formats at the hearing. They did not have an exhibit sticker placed on them. Just the way you run a public hearing really renders that impractical. Documents come in.
What's impractical?
To treat it as a court, strictly as a court proceeding, and
so that begs the question: Can you have a hearing of some kind that is both quasi-judicial and legislative at the same time?
I would suggest that you can, Your Honor. To take an example in the court system, trial courts all the time hold trials where there are different claims involved, maybe some legal claims, maybe some equitable claims, maybe some claims that are tried by the court, maybe some claims that are being heard by a jury. All that evidence is brought in despite the fact that
Do they have a procedure in common in terms of offering evidence and making a record, which
yes,
in due course may well go into the court system?
Yes.
They may share different claims, but they may not be the same claims, but do they share the same procedure?
There is some overlap in the procedures.
Okay.
Yes, that's true. I see that my time is out. Unless there are any other further questions for me, I think the court takes time.
Thank you. Mr. Dobb, good morning to you. You also will have 5 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, may please the court. I'm here representing Darrell Lysy, Redbird, and Ray Anderson, Inc. We describe those people as the developer and as the owner. I've tried to study the Field Club case. There's a caution I have here. The evidence in this case with regard to the specific standing of the developer propose the rezoning and the use permit applications is materially different. At the end of Judge Lamphere's brief for the Field Club, there was a sentence. It's in the argument section. We don't know the 15-year relationship, and it proposes that this waiver procedure is some sort of a partnership with the VA hospital. That record was absent of material information that showed the cognizable interest of the developer as relates to the owner. So the key here is we're looking at, we had a proposal or there's an issue. What is this corporate status of the developer, of the owner? Is there enough in the record to connect that to a good standing position on the standing of the developer to ask for the zoning. So in Field Club, the court looked at that last sentence and said, look, this record's only got the name Kiewit, something about a 15-year relationship, and it said there were two key things missing. One was a certification that the developer had an agency relationship to present the facts as to how the property was going to be rezoned. It wasn't present in Field Club. It's present in this case. It's in the application under the city zoning rule where there's two signatures. That's not contested. It's an uncontested fact. The second thing that...
Counsel, you're talking about the conditional use permit, correct?
No, Your Honor. It's actually the special use permit that the city council voted on and passed an ordinance on.
Okay, thank you.
That's the first step. And in this case, developers always ask or present applications for the thing they needed, which they needed a special permit. They have to, by ordinance, attach to that a development agreement. And in that development agreement, it was clear that Mr. Lisey was going to develop a $5 million project in an already commercially zoned area. And he testified in his first planning board meeting, he said, I'm here because the Anderson family has owned this commercial tract for 10 years. And they've intended to put a strip or a filling station on this site, and they decided to move to another place. All of a sudden, in the record, that is testimony as to the beginning relationship of who was defining this issue of the legal entity. All I need to say is that that plus the fact at the city council meeting, I appeared and I said, I represent the developer and the Anderson family. And at that time, there was complete agreement as well as the agency consent. All that testimony went in, all the testimony of pictures, the opportunity to cross-examine. After six full public hearings, advertised, everything, this issue of ink did not show up. First present here in the standing question. And the testimony is clear that during that process, the applicant, the appellees learned from the legal notices that it was really not just Kiewit, but Ray Anderson, Inc. They knew that from the very beginning. No challenge, no cross-examination, and no evidence in the record of any prejudice that occurred because of that substantial compliance technicality. And when you match that with Field Club, when you match that with the East Roads case, which is an all-force case to this zoning, and then you match it to Smith versus the City of Papillion, you talk about due diligence, complete opportunity to for everybody to know the nature of the development and its characteristics, opportunity to cross-examine, opportunity to present your evidence, the McQuillan standard in municipal corporation treatise law, as well as those three cases, say that when you look at it, technicalities are not the way that zoning works, which the basic criteria is that if there's no substantial prejudice shown in the record with regard to the technicality that you're challenging, Smith and East Roads clearly said, is it fair? Did everybody get a full chance to understand it? Their hearings, all those things. We had a extensive amount of public hearings and advertisements, no showing of adverse substantial impact. The name Kiewit versus Inc., substantial compliance, everybody knew what it was. All of a sudden in this appeal, it shows up.
Let me see if I could summarize the thought to see if I understand it. You're saying this was not litigated below what I'll call maybe the Inc. question. But there was an opportunity for it
to
have been examined. Is that fair enough?
The appellants in this case selected a petition in their proceeding, which bound them to the record. The statute says no more evidence could go in. So in the procedures and the public hearings, all that evidence went in a public hearing format, marked, exhibited. And so the district judge was bound to only look at that to make his ruling.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. So that takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Robert L. Schwatterer.